Max, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 12 minutes for the opening, 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you. May it please the Court, this is an appeal from the Virginia Beach Circuit Court. Final order entered on March 1, 2017. The Honorable James C. Lewis presiding, entering judgments of conviction and court sentences on earlier bench trial findings of second-degree murder, accidental, basically felony second-degree homicide, and imposing a 20-year active sentence on that case, on that charge, and hit-and-run death, imposing a 2-year penitentiary sentence on that charge. There are 3 assignments of error. The first is the denial of a pretrial motion to dismiss. Second is the insufficiency of the evidence to establish criminal agency as to the defendant, as the driver of the vehicle. And third, and perhaps most substantial, while not abandoning the others in any way, is the question of whether this case truly is a second-degree murder charge, felony second-degree homicide in the commission of hit-and-run. One judge... Yes, sir.
Mr. Sachs, assuming for a moment away the criminal agency problem, assuming the evidence was sufficient... You can see that the evidence would be sufficient to support a conviction under 46.2894 if Mr. Pence had in fact lived.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's correct. We don't contest that if there's agency, there would be a felony hit and run.
Okay.
That yes, sir. Now, Your Honor, in my view, and I've been doing this a long time, perhaps not as long as Your Honor's, but particularly the third assignment of error, the felony homicide, is perhaps as substantial an error as I have seen in this court. And I don't fault the trial judge. He did what he thought was best. But if this judgment is upheld, it will upend, I submit, the practice of criminal law in Virginia, because every prosecutor would be almost duty-bound in every hit-and-run case where there's a death to charge a second-degree felony homicide with it. And that's never been the law of Virginia. That would convert simple negligence or no negligence, because you can have a hit-and-run with no negligence, into a second-degree murder. Now, the facts in this case are instructive. A Dominion Power worker observed an unknown man walking through a job site on September 20th in the early morning hours. 15 minutes later, the defendant drove up in a Dodge Durango, stated to the worker that someone needed to call 911 because there was a, quote, guy laying back by the school bleeding from the head, end quote. The driver also told a supervisor at the work site, the Dominion work site supervisor, that, quote, someone had been run over and was bleeding to death and to call 911. The driver then left the scene. One of the workers found the victim, Mr. Ricky Pence, on the ground. Mr. Pence, it was injured. He stated he had been hit but didn't know who hit him. A Virginia Beach police officer noted tire tracks in the soil and pine straw on a concrete island in the area of the injured person. Another officer indicated that there were pavement tire marks in line with the tire imprints in the dirt and pine straw on the island. There was also yellow paint on the inside and the front, on inside of the front and inside of the rear driver's side tires that appeared to match yellow paint from the curb on the median or island that was found in this particular Dodge Durango. The defendant was interviewed the next day. She admitted driving the vehicle on September 20. Said Mr. Pence was a friend, denied any involvement in the hit and run or his death. When she was advised by the officer, she was advised at that time that Mr. Pence had died from his injuries. And while in the room without being questioned but videoed, she made the statement, quote, this was crazy and she thought he would make it. There's a 19-second call on her call log on her cell phone on September 20 from Mr. Pence. He died from blunt force trauma to the head, and there were DNA stipulations that a red stain on the front bumper matched a blood sample of Mr. Pence, and that swabs from the interior, the steering wheel, and the gear shift knob matched up to buckle swabs from the defendant. Of course, the defendant was admitted driving. The defendant did state that she had dropped Mr. Pence off earlier that week at a job site. Now, those are the facts. I would submit, and I'll say it very briefly, with respect to criminal agency, that is not sufficient. I've cited cases.
Didn't the Dominion worker identify her as in the car that morning?
He did. There's no question she was in the car.
How does one explain that she's the driver of the car and his blood being on the bumper?
Well, as I pointed out in my reply brief, it doesn't exclude every reasonable hypothesis of innocence, such which is the requirement. It can't be mere suspicion, can't even be probability, and when it's circumstantial, it must exclude every reasonable hypothesis of innocence. For example, that someone else had struck the victim and the defendant picked up some of the evidence at the scene on her vehicle after the perpetrator had already left had already hit the victim and left. She knew the victim. Now, that's admitted. We can't say somebody else didn't do it and she didn't pick up evidence from being at the scene. Or her statement that she thought that he was going to make it doesn't mean that she was the perpetrator, but could be interpreted as an expression of hope for her injured friend, about whom she had been advised had been struck, but whom she did not, in fact, strike or flee from. So I would simply say, Your Honor, that while it's certainly suspicious, I agree, and even a probability, the cases are legion, that's not enough. It has to be, obviously, beyond a reasonable doubt, and it doesn't exclude every reasonable hypothesis of innocence.
What's the reasonable hypothesis that it was not her as agent? What's the reasonable hypothesis? We've got her at the Dominion scene.
Yes, sir.
That vehicle has the blood on it, yellow markings, all that. She was driving. She's identified. Anyway.
Yes, sir.
What's the reasonable hypothesis that you say has not been excluded?
What I'm saying is that if she was in the vicinity of the accident after it happened and she's driving, she could have picked up some of the evidence. It could have gotten onto her car. It doesn't mean that she had to hit him. She's driving in the area. That's the hypothesis. That's something we don't know.
She could have picked up the yellow paint off the curb where he was lying.
It's conceivable. We don't know what happened. We really have no information about what the dynamics were. We have some possible inferences, some speculation. We don't know what the dynamics were. I mean, automobiles bump up against things. That would be our position, Your Honor.
Regarding the first assignment of error, and I know you want to get to the third, so...
It's all right. I'm going to get to whatever His Honors want me to get to.
Well, on the two charges out of the same conduct, do you agree with the Commonwealth that Blockberger would be, even though you don't raise the constitutional challenges, the appropriate way to look at that?
I do. And I raised it. The criminal agency, I still feel strongly. I didn't try the case, but... I raise that issue because they all, except for the criminal agency, the third assignment, which I think is by far the most substantial and compelling in this case, is a conglomeration of the pretrial motion, the motion to strike after the Commonwealth's evidence, the motion to strike after the conclusion of all the evidence, there was no defense evidence, the argument that there was insufficient evidence beyond a reasonable doubt of felony homicide, and the motion to set aside after the verdict, which I filed. So... And as a practical matter, this defendant received 22 years. She's been in custody since the date of the day after the accident. I think she's overserved. If the 20 years on the second degree were to be reversed and dismissed, she's overserved the 2 years by a year and 9 months. And as a practical lawyer, and I'm not here to, I mean, I know you, we don't rule on practicalities in appellate courts, we rule on principles. But as a practical matter, if their error carries, then this defendant shouldn't be in prison at all. That's what I want to focus on. Your Honor, I don't have much time left, but that to me is the principal substantial error in the case. This is a unique case. I've never seen, and now you all may have as trial judges or as appellate judges, but I'm not aware of another case where a hit-and-run accident was morphed into a second-degree felony homicide. That would be a radical change. I've done a lot of civil work and a lot of criminal work. I've never seen a hit-and-run. Again, as I said, you could have no negligence. Somebody could accidentally, with no negligence at all, be involved in an accident. It could be the other driver's fault. They could be drunk, and they caused the accident. But the individual who was in the accident gets scared, leaves the scene. That becomes second-degree murder under this theory. Cannot make sense. Does not make sense. And on these facts, doesn't make sense. There's nothing different about this case than what I would call, and I say it respectfully, there's a death, but the garden variety, mine run of hit and run cases. There's nothing aggravated. There's no indication. The Commonwealth says, for example, in their brief, their position is, and this is interesting, at page 18, the victim's death was not a mere coincidence. It was the direct and arguably intended consequence of the defendant's actions. There's no evidence of that. No evidence it was intended. In fact, that's contrary to the charge. The charge is it was accidental in the commission of another felony. And as far as it being direct, yes, there was a hit and run, but that doesn't make that. It has to be more than direct. There has to be a nexus, as the law says. And I'm going to cite Griffin v. Commonwealth, which is in our brief at page 18.
Does it matter that the hit and run felony isn't complete until she leaves? He's not injured directly by the leaving, other than perhaps a delay in health care. But just hitting him is not the felony that gives rise to the felony murder as charged, correct?
Correct.
It's the leaving.
It is correct.
How does the leaving contribute to the death?
It doesn't. That's the whole point. It contributes nothing. That's exactly the point. The hitting is what contributes, which caused the death. But the leaving is what's caused the felony. Hitting alone is not, I mean, it may be simple negligence, and I suppose if it were, they didn't charge it, I mean, you could intentionally drive a vehicle into somebody, but that's not the charge here. I think His Honor is exactly right, hit the nail right smack on the head, that the offense here, that it's completed with the leaving. And what Griffin says in the other cases, it is not enough that the killing occur during the felony or while it is being committed. Something more is required than mere coincidence of time and place. And that's what you have here. Every hit and run, unless you have evidence that it was intentional, you know, somebody gunning for somebody, that's not what's charged in this case. And that's not the evidence. You don't have the more than mere coincidence. It was, in effect, a coincidence that it was a hitting that caused the death, a leaving. But the time and place or circumstances are coincidental, too. They have nothing to do with the second-degree murder.
Well, I mean, while it may not be completed until the leaving, the hitting is also part of the hit-and-run felony, correct?
It is part of it. But the felony, as King says, and that's, again, I'm not going to give you all the... It's in my brief, and I see the light is on for 3 minutes. King versus Commonwealth, this court equally stated that, quote, the felony murder rule does not exist to enable courts to impute the act of killing where an accidental death results from fortuitous circumstances and the only connection with the felony is temporal. And that's what you've got.
I have a question that you can either wait until your rebuttal time to answer or I'll ask.
I try not to do that. I try to answer His Honors directly, and I'll do my best.
The classic felony murder case is the death of the bank guard during a bank robbery,
which makes it first degree.
But during the bank robbery itself, the bank robbery is not completed when the guard gets shot. He's shot part and parcel as we're performing the bank robbery, but the robbery is not completed until I leave with the money. How is that different than this?
Because I think that at that point, the robbery that's occurring, first of all, that's first-degree murder. That's first-degree felony murder. And I think where you have a second-degree, this is second-degree. This is an accidental killing in the course of certain other felonies. I think there's a distinction between a violent felony like robbery that's set into motion and is completed only after it's done. There's a difference there. The robbery, the gravamen of the offense, is the taking of the money by violence, threats, or force. Yes, there has to be a completion to it. There has to be an end point. But that has a nexus between the events. And by statute, it has a nexus. By case law, the second-degree murder accidental rule is a little bit different. And what they're talking about is if it's fortuitous. And that's the point. What continues to stick in my head, and maybe it's just my civil experience, I cannot imagine what will happen if, and I say this respectfully, if this court upholds this, and I know you would do it in good faith if you do, but this will dramatically, if I were a prosecutor, I would, every time I had a hit and run, I would charge a second degree murder. It would be automatic. The leverage over the defendants would be incredible. That people could get 20 years, 40 years, it carries 5 to 40, for a hit and run. You could have a scenario, again, where the honest, innocent citizen has nothing to do with the cause of the death. No negligence, no proximate cause in terms of a negligence action, just happens to hit the vehicle at the time or be in an accident. It's really in an accident. They're involved in an accident. The other driver could be totally at fault, but they leave the scene, yet they get hit with second-degree murder. That's an absurd result, and courts do not, as we know, they try to avoid absurd results. Other than the fact that the unfortunate death of this victim occurred during the felony or while it is being committed, I would urge that nothing more exist to provide the nexus. There's got to be that special nexus, more than just temporal nexus, between the hit-and-run felony and the ensuing death, other than, quote, mere coincidence of time and place. That's from Griffin. King, no causal connection exists between the felony. It's a red light.
There is a red light.
I'll just wait until rebuttal if Your Honor's want me to do that.
All right.
All right. Thank you for your time.
Ms. Fitzgerald.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth. The trial court did not err in convicting the defendant in this case of both felony hit and run and also felony homicide. As the defendant has argued mainly his third assignment of error, I will happily address that first unless the Court prefers me to address the questions in order. So with regard to that third assignment of error, this death did occur within the res geste of the underlying felony. The Griffin case, which the defendant relies on, also explains that a death is within the res geste of the felony when it results from an act that was an integral part of the felony. The hit in a felony hit and run is an integral part of the felony. And in this case, as the defendant has stated standing before this court today, and as the court has mentioned, it was that hit which ultimately caused the defendant's death. This was not a coincidence. It was not incidental. It was the direct cause and effect of the defendant's actions in this case. This case is very dissimilar from the King case relied upon by counsel. In King, there was an airplane that had to fly low in the course of smuggling of drugs. The airplane was flying low to avoid cloud cover, and because of the pilot's inexperience, due to the weather and the inexperience, someone ended up dying. That is simply not the case we have here, where the commission of an element of the offense resulted in death. And under those circumstances, that death did occur within the res geste of this felony. I think it's significant, Judge Russell, as you pointed out, that the felony does not have to be complete when the death occurs. Instead, the defendant has to be in the prosecution of that felony. And so the res geste then stretches from the first, I believe it's from the first indictable attempt, all the way through the completed felony. And of course, the defendant in this case did not ultimately expire until 4 hours after the felony was completed. So in the event that was required, it would have been satisfied in this case. Again, Your Honors, I just would reiterate this was an integral part of this felony, and under those circumstances, it was appropriate to charge both of those together. I would note that prosecutors have broad discretion in their charging, and these two code sections, which under the Blockberger analysis do charge different offenses, if a prosecutor feels it's appropriate to charge both those offenses in a single case, they certainly have the discretion to do so. This is not a case where we have multiple punishments being imposed for the same offense, either based on the legislative intent looking at the plain language of these code sections or under the Blockberger test. Hit and run is a traffic offense. It's under 46. Felony homicide, obviously, is a homicide offense under 18.2. They are not both homicide offenses. A death is not required for a conviction under 46.2. And so even just looking at the plain language of those two code sections, this is not a case where multiple offenses are being imposed, or rather multiple punishments for a single offense. And I think that does also play into the res geste analysis because, again, we are looking at separate crimes and separate elements of separate crimes. And here, one of those elements ended up causing the unfortunate death of the victim in this case. I would also note briefly that the evidence was certainly sufficient in this case to find that the defendant was the criminal actor here. The time frame that we're looking at in this case is significant. From about 5:15 in the morning until about 5:30 when the paramedics arrive, it's a very narrow window for two people to be in the abandoned school parking lot at 5 o'clock in the morning. As the court mentioned, the defendant was identified by the Dominion workers at the scene, as was the victim. The defendant admitted that she was driving the Dodge Durango that day. She had the victim's blood on her bumper, the paint from the curb on the tires. Her mail was in the seat, and the victim had called her approximately 2 hours prior. I think it's also significant in this case that the defendant and the victim had a run-in about 2 days prior, where the police had the indication, or the police suspected that the defendant had also tried to run the victim over with her same vehicle at that time. certainly there was enough circumstantial evidence to connect the defendant to this crime. And as this court is well aware, conviction may be based on circumstantial evidence, particularly given the standard of review in this case, the evidence was sufficient to prove the defendant was the criminal actor. I'm happy to address particular questions that the court has on any of the assignments of error. Thank you, Your Honors. I'd ask you to affirm.
Mr. Sachs, technically you are out of time, but I'll give you 30 seconds since my question took up some of my question about when did you want to answer my question.
Oh, I didn't realize the 3 minutes expired. Oh, not a problem, Your Honor. I don't want to, at the risk of repeating myself, I simply want to say I do not think the Commonwealth's argument has answered the core question is, it, in Griffin, it is not enough. They admit the killing did occur during the felony, we all do, or while it is being committed. But something more, what is the something more here is required than mere coincidence of time and place. In every hit and run, injury or death, that's what you have in terms of coincidence of time and place. You don't have the more. You don't have the extra element. It's a hit and run, but it doesn't. It's fortuitous. It's accidental. It's admitted in this case. That's the charge. They haven't answered that. Again, King, I said the felony murder rule does not exist to enable courts to impute the act of killing where the accidental death results from fortuitous circumstances, and the only connection with the felony is temporal. And in addition, I think it belies that. Am I done? Okay. It's in the briefs. I do appreciate your time. I hope I haven't transgressed.
You have not.
Very good. Nice to see all these. Nice to see His Honor Judge Baumgartner, too.
We'll see. Yes. We'll